This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Are you ready for today's lesson?
Yes, Peter!
And listen to your teacher. Repeat after me. I won't grow up.
I won't grow up.
Go to school.
I want to go to school.
Just to learn to be a parrot.
Just to learn to be a parrot.
And recite a silly rule.
And recite a silly rule.
Well, Peter, we do grow up, but you were right. Best to stay a child, or so it may seem. Because when we grow up, we oftentimes forget the beautiful lessons we learn from the stories we knew. Don't venture too far from home. Slow and steady wins the race. Rich can marry poor. Cultures are brought together, and a sense of community is better understood from the fables, fairy tales, fantasies, and folk tales we learned as children. But those stories we knew, well, we still know them. We just forgot the soul with which they were conveyed. So today, let's tell stories, children's stories, with lessons forgotten by adults on Story Hour. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubicek, professor of communication studies at the University of Houston downtown, and along with most of the folks in the studio, a proud member of the Houston Storytellers Guild. And I've got some amazing storytellers this afternoon, and let me just talk to you a little bit about who these folks are and talk about how they're going to help us enjoy this very important theme. You know, mesmerizing audiences since 1990, native Texan Sheila Starks Phillips is on the traveling artist roster of the Texas Commission on the Arts and has been featured at festivals throughout Texas and beyond. She's past president of the Tejas Storytelling Association and past recipient of the prestigious John Henry Falk Award. As a former first grade teacher, Sheila discovered how music and props and animal fun could add to the rhythmic magic of the telling of a tale, as well as creative methods for taking the toughest audience of children on a journey and, like every great teller, return them safely to the present. Yes, I did say animals. You see, Sheila's a former Houston zookeeper. So, Zoo Lady, as she is affectionately called, can not only talk to the animals, but get them to talk back, thanks to her combined knowledge of zoology and performance skills. Also an author, her first children's book, The Extraordinary Surprise, was published in 2001 and represents her signature style. Joe Rader has entertained everyone from preschoolers to senior citizens and everyone in between, swapping Christmas stories at the VA hospital, at the Kela Boardwalk, and numerous festivals statewide. Joe loves stories which speak to her Texas roots. She connects great stories with the warmth of home. She recalls, "I have an aunt whose grandfather told great stories to kids. My mother says she can still see me running up the road to her house every time he came for a visit." Stories and the lessons they teach became her livelihood. First as an elementary and then middle school teacher, then many years as a librarian, always using her roles as a vehicle for teaching our children the wonders of life, the values worth keeping, and beliefs worth holding. Award-winning children's author Jo Harper, I've got two Joes in the studio and they're both female, grew up in the Texas Panhandle, studied at Texas Tech and Penn State. Her short list of achievements include the Willow Literary Award for Prairie Dog Pioneers, the best children's book of 1999, Outrageous, Bodacious, Bolivar Boggs was pick of the list book and presented on PBS Showtime. Both Jalapeno Hal and I Could Eat You Up were selected as books of the month, and her newest book, The Birth of the Fifth Son, is a finalist for the Texas Institute Award in the young adult category. Writer, former English instructor at UHD, active participant in children's literary programs at Title I schools, and consummate teller are best ways to describe this great storyteller, as well as each of these remarkable women. Jo Harper, let's start with you, if we could, for a moment. You know, you are just a fabulous writer. You really are, and I've known you a while, though we haven't interacted for some time. Tell us a little bit about why is it so special to write children's stories?
Well, like most teachers, I wanted to be an influence. And sometimes I go to the library and I pick up a book from long ago that no one's checked out for a long time, And nevertheless, that turns out to be an important experience to me. And so I had the idea that if I wrote books for children, because the world of children remains the same, somebody might read it long after I was gone.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thought. And of course, all writers, I think, really good writers, imagine that their writing serve as a sense of immortality in some ways. You've got a story that you're going to be sharing with us now, Finding Daddy, a story of the Great Depression, which is a very warm, strikingly poignant tale. Share the story with us.
Okay. Called Finding Daddy. And actually, since we're in bad financial times these days, I think it's more appropriate that I had realized when I wrote it. Bonnie couldn't do it. She just could not sing in front of the class. Mrs. Appleby wanted her to. She wanted her to sing at the Thanksgiving assembly in front of the whole school and strangers. She said, "Oh, Bonnie, you sing so beautifully. You shouldn't stay back in the chorus. Just practice here in front of your friends in the classroom." Bonnie tried, but no sound would come out of her throat. She was too shy. After school, her dog Caesar was waiting for her at the edge of the playground. He walked with her to school each morning and met her every afternoon. Daddy said, "You're safe with Caesar." When she got home, she and Caesar played hide-and-seek with the Manning children from next door. When Daddy got home, he played with them. Bonnie wasn't a very good finder, but she could always find Daddy. They lived in a pretty little house. They went in for supper, and Mother had a nice supper waiting for them. But Bonnie's favorite time of day was after supper. That's when Daddy got down the fiddle and the bow, and they sang. Sometimes Mother sang with them. Tonight they sang Alexander's Ragtime Band and A Shanty in Old Shantytown. But things began to change at Bonnie's house. Daddy lost his job. He was home a lot. He taught Bonnie to play the spoons. But he looked worried all the time, even when he smiled. At last, they had to move out of their pretty little house and into an old house. It was ugly, and paint was crumbling off the door. Bonnie knew Daddy felt sad. She wanted to make him feel better. She said, "Daddy, get down your fiddle. We'll sing, and that will make it feel more like home." "Oh, Bonnie, I sold the fiddle." Then Bonnie had to blink hard. She didn't want Daddy to see a tear come out of her eyes. She said, "That's okay, Daddy. We can play the spoons." They sang, "Happy Days Are Here Again." But Bonnie knew the words weren't true. Daddy was around the house more and more, although he went out and looked for work every day. One day he said to Mother, "I'm no good to you. I'm just a burden." The next morning, when he kissed Bonnie and Mother goodbye, he said, "I'll find work today for sure." But Bonnie felt a pain in her heart. Daddy didn't come home that night. He didn't come home the next night, not all week. The house was sad. Mother was there, but she seemed far away. Bonnie told Caesar, "We're not going to school. Not today. We're going to look for Daddy. I can always find Daddy." She went to all the places she could think of that Daddy used to go. She went to the cotton gin. She went to the bench in the park where he used to visit with his friends. She went to the corner where men waited, hoping someone would come and offer them work. But nobody had seen Daddy. At last, she went to a tent city outside of town. people there were huddled around little campfires, and Bonnie and Caesar went from campfire to campfire, but no one had seen Daddy. One woman said, "Some people found work at the port. It's about 10 miles that way." She pointed. Bonnie started walking the way the woman pointed. 10 miles or 10,000 miles, she would find Daddy. It was cold. Bonnie pulled her cap down over her ears. She kept her hands deep in her pockets. A car pulled up beside her. Bonnie's heart pounded. She walked faster and looked straight ahead. She knew she could never get in the car with a stranger, not even with Caesar. "Bonnie, don't you know us? Get in this car before you catch your death of cold." It was Mr. and Mrs. Manning in the car. Bonnie and Caesar jumped in. "Why aren't you in school?" Mr. Manning said. Bonnie fibbed. "Daddy's working at the port. I have to meet him there. Mother's not home." Mr. Manning made a sound that made her think he didn't believe her. But he drove her to the port. Bonnie jumped out quickly. "Thank you," she said. "I know the way." She hurried away. She didn't want the Mannings to go with her. She was so hungry, and as she walked down the street, the warm smell of food came to her. There was a cafe nearby. Bonnie peeped in. There were many people there. Bonnie and Caesar went in. Oh, if only she could ask them all at once, she could find Daddy faster. Bonnie knew how to do it, but she didn't think she was brave enough. "I have to do it. I have to," she told herself. She took some deep breaths, took off her cap and put it on the table, climbed up on a chair and shook out her curls, and Bonnie began to sing. The cafe got quiet. People clapped when she finished the song. Some people put money in her hat. Bonnie sang again and again. People always applauded. Her cap was filling with money. Someone brought her a bowl of beans and a big piece of cornbread. She gave some to Caesar. New people came, and Bonnie sang again. Then she looked around. Caesar wasn't there. "Caesar, your dog's over there." A person pointed to the darkest corner. Bonnie squinted and looked hard. She could see Caesar. His tail was wagging, and he was beside a man who had his hat brim pulled down and a newspaper in front of his face. But Bonnie could see his eyes. She ran to the man and jumped in his lap. It was Daddy. She hugged him and put her head on his shoulder. She felt safe with Daddy. "Daddy, you aren't a burden. You're worth more than all the money in the world. And I've found a way for us to earn." She showed him the money in her cap. Then Daddy played the spoons, and they sang. Suddenly, the door burst open, and Mother and the Mannings rushed in. Mother came over and sang with them. They sang, "Happy days are here again." This time, Bonnie knew the words were true.
Thank you, Joe. That was wonderful. That was so wonderful. And again, we're talking about lessons that adults forgot. And in this troubled time, I was talking to a friend of mine last night who is a victim of these very terrible times. And I was asking him what he was doing. And he was sitting around with his family playing some board game. And he told me he hasn't done that in years, which I think is it's an unfortunate but a very positive byproduct of these times. I think people do find themselves staying at home so much more, and I think that this kind of a story really does demonstrate the importance of family and words like, I love you, and I'm here, and the idea of generosity of love and generosity of giving and generosity of time is the most important kind of generosity, and I think we need to constantly remember that. And I also noticed that the art is beautiful. I know that it's an award-winning art, and I just can't help looking at the front cover, which is just wonderfully expressive, and the faces are so real, and illustration in some of these children's stories are just marvelous, just marvelous. I also think about Robert Fulcrum, you know, the one who wrote Everything I Ever Wanted to Do. I learned in kindergarten, the Unitarian minister who said, when we're young, we learn to share everything, play fair, look both ways, cookies and milk are good for you. Children's stories remind us of those things, things that we really have to remember. You are listening to Story Hour on KPFT with storytellers Joe Rader, Sheila Phillips, and Joe Harper. I'm your host, Hank Rubicek. And, you know, before we move into Sheila, I saw this quote a little while ago that I wanted to share with everybody, and it reads, how do I know what I think until I see what I say, by E.M. Forster. And I can't help sharing that, because sometimes writers really do underestimate the marvelous stories that they do compose and the kind of impact that they make on every one of us. Sheila, you've got your audiences discovering so many things through props and music, and you've got a little guitar here. I know you're not going to be playing the Beatles, although, you know, we may want to hear that a little bit later if you don't mind. I don't know about you, but they're still my favorite group. In the meantime, share with us a little bit about the story that you're about to tell.
The story I'm going to tell is an old one that everybody has heard, The Gingerbread Man, only I've given it a different little twist, and I call it Mr. Bun. Mr. Bun. Just a little bit different, but the same message. Shall I begin?
Absolutely.
A long time ago, not so long ago, there was an old couple that lived way out in the woods. And one day the old man said to the old woman, please make me a bun. And she said, I would love to do that, but we are completely out of flour. Well, he was disappointed, because you know how sometimes you get your taster set for something to eat, and then when you can't have it, you're so disappointed. And that was how he felt. He really had his taster set for a bun. So he said to the old woman, well, maybe you could take a sharp knife and scrape the bottom of the flour barrel and get enough just for one bun. Well, she said she would try. And so she got a sharp knife, and she scraped and scraped and scraped and scraped, and she did get enough for one bun. She put it in a mixing bowl, and she added a little baking powder, a little baking soda, a little pinch of salt. She poured in some milk and took her wooden spoon, and she stirred and stirred and stirred and stirred, and it began to stick together. And then she put it out on a floured board, and she kneaded it back and forth and back and forth until it was in the shape of a bun, just about the size of a hamburger bun. Then she put that bun on a cookie sheet and popped it into a hot oven to bake. And very soon the whole house began to smell of fresh baked bread. Well, when the bun was toasty brown, the old woman put a hot pad on her hand, and she lifted that hot cookie sheet out of the oven. She took a spatula and scraped that bun off that cookie sheet and laid it on a rack and put it in the window to cool. And then she went off to vacuum the bedroom rug. Well, now, while she was gone, the bun got lonely, and the bun rolled off that windowsill, rolled across the floor, rolled right out of the front door of that little house, and rolled right down the path and out of the front gate, and rolled right down the road until he bumped into Mr. Hare. Now, that's a rabbit, you know. Now, Mr. Hare had not had any breakfast that morning, and when he got a whiff of Mr. Bun and how good he smelled, he went, I'm gonna gobble you up. And Mr. Bun said, no you won't. I can run away from you. And he did, and he was singing, I'm Mr. Bun, I'm Mr. Bun. I was kneaded with cream and baked till done. I was set to chill on the windowsill. I got away from Granny and I'll get away from you. Ooh, ooh. And he rolled 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 until he bumped into Mr. Wolf. Now, Mr. Wolf is the kind of guy that will eat anything, and he is pretty much always hungry. He got a whiff of Mr. Bun. He went, I'm gonna gobble you down. And Mr. Bun said, oh, no, you won't. I can roll away from you. And he did, and he was singing, I'm Mr. Bun, I'm Mr. Bun, kneaded with cream and baked till done. I was set to chill on the windowsill. I got away from Granny, I got away from hair, and I'll get away from you. Ooh, ooh. And he rolled, 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 and he rolled until he bumped into Mr. Bear. Now, Mr. Bear, because he's such a big, big guy, has an enormous appetite. And he got a whiff of Mr. Bun. He went, I'm gonna gobble you down. And Mr. Bun said, oh, no, you won't. I can roll away from you. And he did, and he was singing, I'm Mr. Bun, I'm Mr. Bun, I was kneaded with cream and baked till done, set to chill on the windowsill. I got away from Granny, I got away from hair, I got away from Wolf, and I get away from you. Ooh, ooh. And he rolled, 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 and he rolled until he bumped into Mr. Fox. Oh, dear. Now, Mr. Fox was not a very nice fella. He often said things that were not true. He just was not a nice man. And he said, why, hello there, Mr. Bun. Don't you look so nice and warm and toasty this morning? I heard you singing. What a nice voice you have. Do you suppose you could sing that song again just for me? Well, that silly Mr. Bun was so pleased and flattered to be complimented like that that he began to sing the song again. I'm Mr. Bun, I'm Mr. Bun, kneaded with cream and baked till done. I was set to chill on the windowsill. I got away from Granny, I got away from hair, I got away from Wolf, and I got away from Bear, and I get away from you. Ooh, ooh. And Mr. Fox said, oh, that really was nice. But you know what? I'm just a little bit hard of hearing. Do you suppose you could sing that song again just for me and maybe come a little closer? Maybe you could hop up on my nose. Well, that silly Mr. Bun was so pleased and flattered to be complimented like that he hopped right up on the fox's nose and began to sing again. I'm Mr. Bun, I'm Mr. Bun, I was kneaded with cream and baked till done, set to chill on the windowsill. I got away from Granny, I got away from hair, got away from Wolf, and I got away from Bear, and I'll get away from you. Ooh. Oh, and Mr. Fox ate Mr. Bun right down. Ooh. And there you have it.
That's great. You know, we have three bona fide adults tapping their knees as you're telling that wonderful story so rhythmically, and we have our headphones on. Reminds me of the Mickey Mouse Club. Those of you old enough to remember, and all of us fall under that category, certainly can remember that. That was so great. Now, Sheila, you're wonderful at telling kids what stories mean, because I know you did that in my class yesterday, and this story is fun, and we don't want to lose sight of some of the real essence of what the story does. If you were talking to a bunch of little kids right now and asked them questions or wanted them to understand the meaning of this story, what would it be? Anything in particular?
Yes, there is. And every time I tell that story, I always end it, what did we learn from this story? And I get the most wonderful answers. And the most common one, believe it or not, is never hop up on a fox's nose. And I always agree, right. That's not a good idea. But then we finally get around to that it's very unwise to talk to strangers.
Yeah.
And we talk about that a little bit. And what do you do if a stranger approaches you?
Yeah.
We talk about running and screaming and all the things you do.
That's wonderful. Thank you. You know, and that's certainly a very important lesson for children to understand. But we don't want to lose sight of the fact that this is also the kind of story that a parent, a teacher, can tell a child in order to get that child to understand the importance of not talking to strangers.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, when we talk about the kind of lessons that adults forget, sometimes we also forget that stories are terrific avenues to teach our kids things that we might not be able to describe or communicate otherwise, right? I love that story, and I want you to know that Sheila was terrific at calling him Mr. Bun as opposed to the Gingerbread Man, because we didn't want the station to be sued by the Gingerbread Consulate, and we wanted to make sure that we can neutralize that as best as possible. And thank you so much for doing that. That was so great. I love the story. You know what the limberjacks are? Those little wooden things that kind of sit on your knee.
And oh, yeah, I have one of those, yes.
I'm the only abnormal person that has one.
I have one, too.
But I tell this story to myself, actually to my dachshund and beagle, which tells you about my life. But half the time I'm sitting around and I'm going, you know, run just as fast as you can. Can't catch me because I'm the gingerbread man. Ah. And I'm thinking to myself, nobody cares other than me. But children's stories can do that. Somehow you can entertain yourself and recognize that there are things that happen with children's stories that just don't happen with adult stories. You use music a great deal.
I do.
And clearly there's a lot of rhythm. What does it do to you as a storyteller? How does it help you to orchestrate or to regulate a story with the use of music?
I have found that music so enhances any story, a children's story or an adult story. It just enhances it. And people like that, if you're just doing a little few little chords as background, never singing or doing anything, just doing a rhythm on it.
Mm-hmm.
It just adds so much to the story, and people really like that. I'm always amused that I can play three chords, and the kids think I'm a virtuoso on the guitar. And I just puff all up and they say, oh, you're just wonderful. And I'll say, well, thank you.
Music gives it just a tremendous element of play. It really does.
It is.
I thought we might just take a minute and talk about some of the genres of storytelling, because I think that if we understand some of the genres of children's stories, we understand what they can really teach our kids and what adults can get out of them. We know that fables, for example, and you're very good at fables because you use animals.
Mm-hmm.
And animals personify the human condition, and there's always a moral.
Right.
And that's what Aesop was always noted for, and those are wonderful stories because they teach us very real, very concrete morals. We know that fairy tales are important, but they also have familiar surroundings. You know, Hansel and Gretel's walking in a woods. We've seen the woods. We've seen houses. We've seen trees, which is what makes them kind of scary, but also very engaging in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
We know that myths are ways to explain the inexplicable sometimes. And we know that folk tales, which are my personal favorite, keeps customs and legends alive. And that's always fun, because telling stories about customs and legends gives us a sense of community and brings that community together, which is just wonderful. You are enjoying, we hope you're enjoying, Children's Stories with Lessons Adults Forgot on KPFT Story Hour. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubichek, and we are spending magical time, I think, with storytellers Joe Rader, Joe Harper, and Sheila Phillips. Joe Rader, you know, you've been a librarian for a lot of years, and as we were talking before this program, and I know it sounds kind of a joke, but there are some kids who probably don't even think a library exists anymore. You know, those buildings with books, they still are around? Yeah. And I know that you're very sensitive to this, and you love the idea of libraries being around and kids being able to take books out, but what are some of the basic trends that you've noticed in the last decade that take place in children's stories? Are there different messages that are collectively being communicated now as opposed to, say, 10 years ago?
I believe that even though I've been retired 5 years, I've talked to other librarians, and I still visit a lot of libraries. And the books are still there that are filled with what we consider basic, solid family values. The only changes you might see, or that the families might not be quite the same. You might have a latchkey kid in the story. You might have a single parent. There are cultural diversities. But the family values, I believe, are still there. They're still in the storybooks.
Good. So fortunately, the basic values have remained.
I think so.
And you've got a terrific story to kind of prove that point. You've got a marvelous story about how generosity replaces greed.
It seems timely for all the news we've been reading and hearing for the last several months, perhaps even years.
Yeah, I agree.
This story can be found in the Reader's Digest book of American Folklore and Legends. It's also a beautiful picture book with the story retold by Alan Shepard. When I go to the grocery store for a dozen eggs, I come home with a carton of 12 eggs. When I go by the donut shop for a dozen donuts, I come home with a bag of 12 donuts. This story is about a different sort of dozen. In the early days of America, in what we know as colonial times, there was a baker in the valley village of Albany Town whose name was Van Amsterdam. Van Amsterdam was a wonderful baker. Everything he baked was delicious. Breads, rolls, pies, cakes, muffins, and he always used the finest ingredients. Once during the winter holidays, he cut the shape of a round little man from a bit of leftover cookie dough. He gave him raisins for eyes, a bit of a walnut for a nose, and popped him into the oven to bake. When the cookie was done, he frosted it with red and white icing, and Van Amsterdam had created the first ever St. Nicholas cookie. He placed it in his shop window so people could see it as they walked by. Well, people started coming into his shop and ordering those cookies by the dozen. And of course, when they came into his shop for the cookies, they bought his other baked items as well. His St. Nicholas cookie was famous. People came from nearby villages and towns just to visit Van Amsterdam's bake shop and buy those cookies. Well, he was making more money than he had ever made. So one day he decided if he didn't use quite as many of the fine ingredients he had always baked his baked items with, people probably wouldn't notice. And maybe at first they didn't. And if he wasn't using all these fine ingredients, there would be more money for him. Well, things weren't turning out quite right, but people thought they've got to be the best. After all, Van Amsterdam is famous. Late one afternoon, just before he closed his shop, an old woman came in. She had a black shawl wrapped around her head. "Van Amsterdam, I have come to purchase one dozen of your famous St. Nicholas cookies." "Yes, ma'am," he said. She handed him a cloth bag. He counted 12 cookies into it and handed the bag back to her. She looked inside and she counted. "Van Amsterdam, I asked for a dozen cookies and you've only given me 12, not 13. He said, "Madam, 13 would be one cookie too many. 12 cookies or a dozen." "No, Van Amsterdam, 13 or a dozen, and you are a selfish man." He was not going to be insulted in his own shop. So he told her she could just take her business elsewhere. As she swept out the door, she looked back at him and said, "You will be sorry." The next day, nothing he baked turned out right. His cookies were as hard as rocks, too hard to even bite. His pies were too sour or too sweet. And he thought, well, things will be better tomorrow. But they weren't. The next day, his breads all crumbled. His cakes rose high, then fell flat. And this went on day after day after day. And his customers stopped coming. Van Amsterdam might be famous, but his baked items just weren't good anymore. One day he sat in his almost empty shop, nothing left but a few of those St. Nicholas cookies. He was wondering how business could have gotten so bad so fast. Now, it might have been the tears blurring his eyes, but he thought he saw the mouth of one of those cookies move. He definitely heard a voice say, "You will never be rich because you are greedy." Just then, that same old woman came back into his shop, still wrapped in her black shawl. "Van Amsterdam, I have come to purchase one dozen of your St. Nicholas cookies." Well, he took her cloth bag, counted 12 cookies into it, looked up at her, put in one more, She smiled at him, took her bag of cookies, and left. Now, the very next day, Van Amsterdam started following his recipes exactly. He started using the finest ingredients that he could possibly find. He even added extra ingredients to make his items more delicious. More butter, more eggs, more honey. And he got, his customers all came back. Not only that, they learned that when you bought a dozen of anything, rolls, muffins, cookies, at Van Amsterdam's bake shop, you not only got 12, you got 13. Because Van Amsterdam had learned, when generosity replaces greed, good fortune follows. And that's the baker's dozen.
Thank you, Joe. That was terrific. I'm always thinking about this folk tale, and I don't even remember from where it comes. It was a story about an older man who had a terrific relationship with God. And one day, God visited him. Much to his surprise, the elderly man, as you might imagine, after all, he's getting a visit from God. And God said, you know, I'm going to try something a little bit different, because there's an awful lot of greed in the world. A lot of people who really need to learn the benefit of generosity. You're a good man, and I'm going to show you the difference between heaven and hell. And when I do, I'd like you to share with the people that you know how wonderful heaven can be. But that means that you're going to have to talk with them about the power of generosity. So let me show you the difference. And he takes the elderly man down a very long corridor and asks the man to open it. And the man opens the door and he sees a very long picnic table. And around the table, you see dozens and dozens of people. And in the center of the table, the most magnificent food you've ever seen. Just unbelievable food, just a smorgasbord, a kaleidoscope of magnificent dishes. And every person is holding a fork and is virtually paralyzed, can't get to the food. And God turns to the elderly man and says, this is hell. Well, he turns around and walks down the other corridor, asks the man to open up this door, and the man opens it up, and the man sees exactly the same scenario. He sees a very long table with the most exquisite food, many people sitting around the table with silverware, but this time each individual had their elbows, fingers, and arms strung up so that they could help each other dine on this magnificent food. So everybody was able to help everyone else eat. And God said to the elderly man, this is heaven. And he got the idea. And I think the idea of working with each other and being very related to each other and understanding that none of us are as good as all of us, which I think is a very important, very general theme, is a very critical one when it comes to generosity. That's a beautiful story, Joe. Thank you so very much. And it's something we just can't forget. We cannot possibly forget the power of generosity. Giving of ourselves is everything. Now, I'm going to ask the three of you about your favorite bedtime story, so you might want to think about for that and for just a moment, because I wanted to make just a couple of announcements. The Storytellers Guild, a proud member I am, and in fact, it's a fabulous organization. Joe, we want you to be a member. Joe Harper, she's the only one not a member, but she will be now. She has no choice because that was part of this contract. But the Storytellers Guild, a great organization, meets every third Thursday of the month at 7 o'clock, actually 6:30 for a little bit of talk and fun, but 7 o'clock for story swapping, and it is at the Montrose Library, which is right next to the Black Lab. And whether you are a great storyteller or not, we know you're a lot better than you think. But if you love stories, this is the place for you. And if you're like most of the storytellers, they drink excessively next door and come in and they have no idea what they're doing anyway, and they're all pretty magnificent. But we want you to come the third Thursday of every month, please. A lot of fun, a lot of fun. Also, we have a great website, www.HoustonStorytellers.org. Take a look at it and take a look at some of the tellers and some of the upcoming events, and we'll be more than happy to join you, for you to join us. Also, I wanted to make an announcement that Sheila Phillips, the bun lady over here with the guitar, will be at 1894 Opera House, the 1894 Opera House, I should say, on April 26th at 3 o'clock in the afternoon in Galveston, and she'll be telling love stories. And we all know how much we all love love stories. The February 13th program that we did here on Story Hour was dedicated to love stories right before Valentine's Day, and those are always a treat. So make plans to see Sheila. I don't think you'll be at all disappointed. These are all magnificent storytellers here in the studio today, and I'm always thinking about how good storytellers are able to take things and wonderfully embellish them. The frog jumps a little higher, the heart beats a little faster, love is a little deeper, the experience was just a little bit better, and it always reminds me of Ernest Hemingway's quote, "The writer's standard of fidelity to the truth should be so high that his or her invention should produce a truer account than anything factual can be." So sometimes, even though our stories are wonderfully and descriptively embellished, that really is the truth, because they come from our experience base. They're things that we see, things that we imagine. And that's the beauty of stories and the beauty of the lessons within them. Okay, favorite bedtime story. What do you think? Joe, let's start with you.
I don't know that I have a favorite bedtime story.
Is that what you're saying? I never slept. Okay.
When I was young, my mother would read me the Uncle Wiggily stories. I'm not even sure you can still find Uncle Wiggily stories.
Uncle Wiggily.
He was a rabbit.
Yeah.
Yes, he was
okay.
a rabbit.
Okay, I remember that. Yeah, yeah, I'm over the age of 21 also. Oh, yeah. Uncle Wiggily.
She would read me those. But when my children were bedtime story age, what I would find myself doing most was putting them into the as the character of the story. I would start off with whatever, you know, the little boy had such and such for breakfast, then he went to school and this is what happened, or the little girl, blah blah, and he or she would soon realize it was them. They were in the story, and those are the bedtime stories I liked to tell my children, just made up about their day.
That's great. That's great. So they really could reminisce about their day through Uncle Wiggily.
Oh, yeah. I think it might. No, not through Uncle Wiggily. This wasn't Uncle Wiggily.
I'm sorry. I'm so confused. I'm so Uncle Wiggily possessed now.
I have to go.
Now we have to go find the ugly. I can't speak. I just teach speech. The Uncle Wiggily.
But these were stories I would just make up.
Yeah.
And they would be about my child's day. And it seemed to tickle them that they were in the story.
That's great. Sheila, do you have a favorite bedtime story?
Well, I do remember those Uncle Wiggily stories. I do. My favorite, though, were not the traditional stories that you would expect, the folk tales or whatever, but my favorite stories to hear were the personal stories of my mom and daddy as they were kids growing up. And it fascinated me that they actually had an ice box that had big old blocks of ice in it and that sort of thing, because that was so foreign. And we can do the same thing now with our own kids, because to them, a life without iPods and computers and even the simple things like fax machines is just absolutely unheard of to them. So they like to hear those stories. They're fascinated by it. And that you would actually have to defrost your refrigerator.
Isn't that
Please.
Amazing? I know. That's so.
So those were my favorite, the actual personal stories of my parents.
Yeah, personal narratives.
When they were
those.
Kids.
Yeah. I enjoyed those too. And as I was explaining to the three of you before the program, in my home, we only could tell stories. That was the only way I could be heard. The only way people would sit there long enough to hear what I had to say is to say, "So let me start with," they would go, "Oh, for God's sake." So they'd have to sit there and listen to the entire thing. "How was your day at school?" "Well, let me start with English. I walked in and all of a sudden I'm giving a story," and they had to sit there. It was a way of getting their attention, but it worked. Joe, do you have a favorite bedtime story?
Well, you know, I don't, except that at bedtime, I think about whatever ones I'm working on. And so my most recent book is of Aztec and Mesoamerican stories. So those are the ones I think about. And what I like about those is they have such a different sense of humor. Their gods were always having so much trouble. It was so much trouble to make the world. It took them five times to make the sun. And the people were just a terrible problem. there was something wrong with every bunch. One bunch was so big that they could only eat things from the tops of the trees. And if they fell down, they couldn't get up. So it was polite when you met a person to say, "Don't fall down." And if you wanted to be very polite, you said, "Don't fall down. Oh, please, don't fall down." So I like to think about those little different ways of looking at the world.
And they're wonderful ways. The stories that I remember, my grandmother saying all of her stories, I don't know where she learned them, but she was really an amazing person. My grandmother, my grandfather, my mother were all Holocaust survivors. They had a slate of stories that were really pretty remarkable, but they had an incredible way of simplifying them so that a child could understand it, which I think is a real skill, because those are pretty scary stories, and they certainly can be. And somehow they were always filled with wisdom. And then they would tell other stories that I remember. For example, I would, whenever I was worried about things, and I'm still a worrier, but not nearly as much as I used to be, I would ask my grandmother questions, and I would ask her that I would tell her that I'm worried. And I remember she would tell me stories like, she would say, "Well, you know, there was a story about this little boy and a mother who was at a bazaar, at a fair. And they won a couch." I'm thinking, "Oh, brother, where is she headed with this one?" She said, "And they won a couch." And the little boy said to the mother, "I'm going to jump on that couch when the couch arrives." And the mother said, "Oh, no, you're not." "Oh, yes, I am. I'm going to jump all over that couch. I'm going to rip it apart. I'm going to treat it like a trampoline. I'm going to jump and jump and jump until the springs come out." And the mother said, "Oh, no, you are not going to jump on that couch." "Yes, I am." "No, you're not." Well, they had this argument, and they became so angry with each other, they didn't talk for years. And you know what? The couch never showed up. Now, we think about that, and when you're about 10 years old, you're thinking, "Huh? What? Am I missing something?" But we're all smiling now because wasn't missing a thing, was it? I mean, there was something there that we learned. We worry about things, and sometimes those things never happen, right? And we sometimes become very upset and very angry with others. And we think that somehow we just have a right to worry about things, and we can't, because we can't control any of these things. I think that in some magical, even strange sort of a way, I think children's stories teach us that as well. One of the things that just occurred to me in listening to these wonderful, wonderful storytellers in the studio today is that in order to tell a really good story with a very poignant lesson, I think you need not only to be educated and skilled, but I think you have to have some kind of heart, some passion that is almost indescribable. I'm always remembering what Emerson once said. He said that people are like poets, and there are two kind of poets in the world: the one born of education, the one that we respect, and the one born of love, heart, the one we really do love. And I think that today in the studio we have three storytellers who are incredibly skilled at doing exactly what Emerson pronounced, and that is being a poet of education, the one that we respect, and one of heart, the one that we love. And it's really an incredible, incredible combination. We just have a little bit of time left, but when we think about lessons, what's one overriding lesson we don't want adults to forget? One word, one lesson. What do you think? Joe, what's one word, one lesson?
Empathy.
Great. Empathy.
What do kindness.
You, empathy, kindness, and...
And she stole my word, kindness. That was my first
That
one.
Is okay, because kindness is one of those words that can certainly be repeated.
Yeah. My next one
that.
Was going to be good manners really do matter.
Good manners,
anyway,
yeah.
That's almost been lost.
Oh, I hear Peter Pan again. I hear Neverland. Oh, my goodness. Peter Pan is totally surrounding us. Well, you know, I have got to thank all of you, Joe Rader, Sheila Phillips, and Joe Harper, for your lessons and children's stories that adults forgot. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubicek, and I got to tell you, published or personal, teach your kids great lessons through great stories and remember them yourselves. Because when our children think about fairness, integrity, and wisdom, I think they ought to be thinking about us. So have a wonderfully happy Easter, a very happy Passover, and an absolutely terrific weekend.
You have been listening to Open Journal, KPFT's experiment in community-inspired radio. Since 1970, KPFT has been a unique voice on the Houston airwaves. Rather than rely on commercials or underwriting, KPFT relies on listener donations. Our management model takes a radically democratic approach where listeners can participate at many levels of KPFT, offer ideas for vision, and help lead us in bold new directions. Call 713-526-4000 to inquire about membership and our great thank you gifts available for your pledge of support.